You're listening to Well Made. I'm your host, Stefan Ango, co-founder of Limi. Today we're talking to Jess Hatzis. She's the co-founder of Frank Body. It's a brand known for its coffee-based skincare products. You may have seen them on Instagram. They've taken Instagram by storm. And since they launched about 4 years ago, I've always admired the cheeky and unexpected copywriting style that they use. As the creative director of Frank Body, Jess has had a major role to play in shaping and building the voice and tone and the organization around it. This was an incredibly fun and insightful conversation. You're going to learn a lot about marketing, a lot about explaining your products and your brand. Enjoy it. Jess Hatzis, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. How are you?
Very good. I'm excited to have you. So I thought I'm going to give it a try and explain what you guys do, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong.
But sure.
You're the founder of Frank Body, and it is a company that makes coffee-based skincare. I think the product that maybe most people would be familiar with is your scrub, your body scrub, but You guys have expanded into lotions and moisturizers and all kinds of things like that. Is that a good summary?
That's a pretty good summary of one part of what I do. Yeah.
How do you explain it?
I usually call myself a writer, to be honest, because that's what I started doing. But you nailed the way that we describe Frank Body. So we started with just that single product, the original body scrub, about 3 years ago. And it was really started as a side project. I don't think we had any intentions to kind of grow into the brand that we are today. But now we produce a line of 13 products and we're stocked in retailers all over the world.
And so people will recognize by your accent that you're based in Australia, or you're from Australia and based there. And here's my pronunciation question I have for you. Tell me how you pronounce the city that you're in.
I knew you were going to ask me that. So imagine if you spelled Melbourne with a B-I-N on the end, and then that's how we pronounce it.
Melbourne.
Ours don't exist in the Australian language, apparently.
What do you call someone who lives in Melbourne?
I guess Melburnians, but we don't say that very often.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, it's just funny. I think that in the States, there's all kinds of places like that, like New Orleans, people say Nolans or something like that if you come from there. But I don't think that the expectation is as strong. It's interesting. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's really for some reason, I happen to know people from there, and they're very precise about the way they pronounce it.
Oh, yes. We make a lot of effort to ensure that you don't say your R's if you're talking about our city.
So you mentioned that you consider yourself a writer. It certainly comes out in what you guys do with Frank, because I would say if anybody's ever been to your website or to your social media, the way you guys speak about the products is very specific. I'm kind of curious to hear more about the beginnings of getting into writing. What got you into that, especially copywriting? That's pretty specific.
Yeah, I'd always loved writing. And I think when I was at university, I didn't really know what it was that I wanted to do. And I didn't realize that I was already doing it. So I was writing a lot, particularly about music. That was my passion. And I started a side project called Willow and Blake with two other girlfriends that I was working the same part-time job as. And they were both studying journalism, and together we found this mutual love of writing. We really started it as a side project to just be writing pieces that were not going to be edited to within an inch of their lives. And we really wanted to focus on the people behind different projects rather than the projects themselves. I guess much in the same way that you are on this podcast, we kind of got quite a bit of traction off the back of that. It was really interesting. I think people liked perhaps the fresh tone and I guess the relaxed nature of the writing. And from there, a lot of copywriting requests started to come in. And we've been doing it for about 18 months at that point. And we were all working in-house at agencies as copywriters and social media content creators. And we decided to take a bit of a leap and start Willow and Blake as an agency. We were particularly focusing in on copywriting. This was about 6 or 7 years ago. And I guess at the time we'd noticed that there was a huge void in the market. There were agencies focusing on design and PR and events, but the written word was kind of like this unloved component and what we thought was probably one of the most crucial components. And no one was actually really focusing on doing it well. So we started like every startup. On our first day of work, we wore our pajamas and sat at the kitchen table and really had no idea what it is that we were trying to do and achieve. But bit by bit, we started getting, I guess, different freelance inquiries, and we were just hustling all the time, trying to get work. Every person that we knew that was starting a business, we were in their ear, working and writing for free just to try and make a name for ourselves. So eventually that team grew and we took on our first employee, which was probably the scariest time of my life because all of a sudden you're responsible for another human's livelihood. And then about 3.5 years into that project, the three of us that had started Willow and Blake together and two other friends came together, and we knew that we wanted to move into a product-based industry. I think everything that we were all doing was so service-based and the scalability there was limited. So Steve, who's one of my co-founders at Frank Body, was actually the person that came to us with the original product idea for the coffee scrub. He owns a few cafes in Melbourne, and he had two women come in and ask him for the coffee grinds from the machine. And he assumed that they were taking it home to use it as a garden fertilizer. And it turned out that they like to use it for themselves as a body scrub in the shower. And that was how Frank started. We got in the kitchen and we were just making up these recipes using natural oils and different ingredients that we could get our hands on. And we got in the shower and we covered ourselves in this stuff that looks like dirt, felt absolutely ridiculous. And then rinsed it off and felt incredible. And it was like nothing that we'd ever tried before. And it was right on the cusp of this health and wellness trend that was sort of sweeping through social media at the time in, say, early 2013. And I think we knew that we had something really interesting and really different, but that what was actually really going to make this product stand out was the brand and the voice behind it. And yeah, like you said, the voice of Frank Body is probably one of the most noteworthy parts of the brand.
Yeah, I think, but one thing that's interesting is there's a big difference between writing a blog and writing copy that is meant to sell a product. What did you learn in those years doing Willow and Blake? Did you ever read any books about copywriting? How did you educate yourself on writing copy that sells?
Yeah, we'd all studied marketing and communications and journalism at university, but frankly, that doesn't really prepare you for much in the real world, I think. It was a lot of trial and error and a lot of thinking about things from a consumer's perspective. I think it's really lost, like it's really easy to get lost up your own ass when you work in ad land and people think that they're developing this brilliant, genius copy and then you give it to someone else to read and they're like, I've got no idea what it is that you're trying to say here. And so we did a lot of that, like talking to our friends, like, how do you think of this? Like, what does this message say to you? And a lot of strength testing our own ideas, a lot of getting told by clients, you really fucked that up. Sorry, are we allowed to cuss on this show?
Yeah, yes, it's great. Fine.
And, you know, we got things wrong a lot at the start. And I think it's willing to be wrong is how you learn to be right more of the time.
That's interesting because it's I've done a lot of the copywriting for Lumi over the years, and I've only ever read one copywriting book, which is the it's called, I think, Copywriter's Handbook. I think I just found it by looking up, you know, Amazon number one, whatever, the copywriting books by Robert Bly. And I think it was written in the 60s or something. So
yeah.
I still recommend it to people because it does sort of get you in the mindset of just that basic idea that if you're writing copy that is going to, like, let's say, live next to a product on a website, it should try to sell that product.
Oh, exactly.
But that's about it. I couldn't tell you anything from the book specifically. But yeah, I think trial and error is definitely the way to go when you're learning how to write good copy.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Like, reading different resources, like, we spent a lot of time on the internet. And at the time, I couldn't find any good books that were specifically about copywriting. But we were reading about design, and I think all of these things are so intrinsically linked, and you can't really look at copy in isolation when it comes to selling a brand. And after about a year, we realized that we were doing this whole strategy component for our clients without even realizing that we were doing it. And our formula became kind of stepping back and doing a bit of an analysis on the brand and the competitors in the market and trying to figure out who our audience was and what their triggers were, and then developing a tone of voice strategy from there that would kind of be the idea that underpinned everything that we would do for that brand. And if you don't have that, that's how you end up with this really wishy-washy, trend-driven version of a brand that nobody can buy into. So that's probably one of the most important things that we do for not only Frank, but for our clients at Willow & Blake.
But before we go into the personality and the voice of Frank, aside from books, were there brands that you looked up to that you felt were doing a really good job establishing a voice?
Yeah, I think one of the standout ones to me from the time we started was actually MailChimp.
Oh man, I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, they were one of the first for sure.
They were one of the first and they were pretty new, I guess, 6 or 7 years ago. But they knew who they were and they made these really boring error communications actually sound really fun. So they're one that definitely stand out in my mind and they've stayed true to their voice for as long as we've been using them.
Yeah, they have this, the chimp character, Freddy, and they have a website, I think still, you could probably still find it. I think it's called voiceandtone.com where they describe exactly how Freddy speaks and how he would say certain things in certain contexts. And that's a very, very helpful tool once you kind of create that Bible that as you grow, you can make sure that everyone in the organization is using that as a template.
Oh, yes. One of the most important and painful experiences Brie and I have ever undertaken, because we were the copywriters for Frank for the first couple of years and we still write a lot of the copy, but we have a team that work with us. So obviously we had to create a brand guide for them. And you know how important this thing is to do for your team, but sitting down and writing 60 pages of copy guidelines when you know it's all in your head and you're like, I've got so much shit to do instead of just writing what it is that I already do. It starts to feel like a really redundant process, but you don't realize until later on when you see them actually really nailing their job, how important setting up all of that foundational work is.
Can you share a little bit about the personality of Frank and what sounds right and what doesn't? What would Frank never say, for instance?
I actually had this conversation with one of my design team when we were on our shoot last week. We were, we call everybody babes, but we would never say bae. I hate that word so much. And she just looked at me. She's like, why? I'm like, he just wouldn't. He's too cool for that. but I mean, the voice from Frank came about because at the time when we were creating it, we were looking at this product that essentially looked like dirt. And we were packaging up in a brown coffee bag and it was coming flat packed in the mail. There was nothing glamorous about this product. Like, it was really amazing to use, but it was very humble looking. And in the wider industry or the wider beauty industry at the time, there was just this overflux of like scientific jargon and hyperbole, and everything was a lot more complicated than it needed to be. And brands were very disconnected from their consumers. There wasn't really any conversation going on between them. So we knew we were going to be launching this product that looked like dirt, and we had to be really honest and really upfront about what it was and just really frank about it. So that was where I guess the brand identity stemmed from, this concept of let's be frank. We'll be frank about our ingredients, our product, and then a whole variety of topics. And from there, we decided to create the character of Frank because we were using social media primarily to market our brand because we were a startup and we didn't really have any money to do anything else. And we knew that more specifically, that's where our consumers were. But to be a brand playing on social media, which was a space at the time largely just used by friends, you had to be talking to them like they're friends. You couldn't come on as a corporate brand and try and play in their space. So creating the character of Frank allowed us to talk in first person to our consumers and actually have these really lovely, cheeky one-on-one communications with them and build a rapport and build genuine relationships. And I, to this day, believe even though we make a beautiful product that it's the brands that people bought into first before they fell in love with the product. And it's something that you see on every touch point. There is no point of communications that goes out to our consumers that hasn't been edited by probably 3 copywriters, from our shipping confirmations to the stickers that seal our envelopes when you receive them in the mail. Everything is considered because it's all of those elements that add up and create a really beautiful brand experience, which I'm sure you're very familiar with too.
Well, so, but it's interesting because you take that cohesive approach to copywriting all the way into the customer service. So whenever you reply to someone who's commented on something on social media, you reply in the voice of Frank.
Yeah.
Do you do that for emails when it's a longer communication, even in that context as well?
Oh, like, no, if I'm talking to a business development partner.
Right. No, of course not. But if someone, so what's the difference in your mind between someone who posts on social media a comment or a question, and then you reply as the Frank character, versus someone who maybe asks that same question in an email form?
If it's coming through to our customer service team, there isn't really any difference. For us, we need to be true to our brand no matter where we're communicating with customers. So our customer service team have got the copy Bible as well, and they spend a lot of time working out how to reply appropriately to people that are experiencing potential shipping issues whilst also being true to the brand and the character of Frank. So
they do actually reply as Frank in emails too?
Every now and then they'll reply as Frank, or they'll reply as Frankfurt X and they'll insert their name there. But even the copy is still in exactly the same kind of cheeky,
right,
fun-loving tone.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. And I think for them, it makes their job more enjoyable, right? Because replying to disgruntled customers can be a really tough job. And then for the consumer on the other end, dealing with an issue, say they've bought something and it hasn't arrived on time, actually feeling like you're talking to a human on the other end that understands you rather than an automated reply, it gets them on side more. And I think that they realize that they're really important to us because we're taking the time to really continue the brand experience for them in that kind of area.
I could do 5 hours just on this topic. I really actually want to know more because, like, I'm going to have to cut myself off. But have you ever considered actually publishing your copywriting Bible? The reason why you and I remember MailChimp for their copywriting is partially because of that document that they published. And it's not like everybody went and copied them. Do you think that that's something you would ever consider doing?
I won't lie, I've never actually thought about that. I don't see any harm in it, to be honest. I mean, if it helps other brands do a great job when it comes to their communications, then why not?
I think you should consider it because
yeah.
I wish more people spent more time thinking about how they communicate, and there's just not enough good examples out there.
A lot of the time what I notice is that people want to rush that component of their business development without realizing that taking a little bit more time at the start to really develop that and understand who you are as a brand has so many implications further down the track. And doing that legwork first will save you so much time later on. But it's, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing, right? You never know that until you're a year into a project. So maybe keep your eyes peeled. I wonder what we could call it.
I'm sure you'll come up with some great ideas.
I'll let you know. I'll credit you.
Well, you know, one thing that we're doing at Lumi is we're going to be launching a video series. It's very short, 2 or 3 minute videos. And my co-founder, Jesse, is the host of it. It's basically videos about packaging. And they're all just sort of tips. And the show is called Shipping Things. She has these sort of magical powers in the show where hands will come in and help her do certain things that she's trying to explain. And we had to kind of write a Bible for that too, because we had to decide what superpowers does she have in this world and what is she allowed to do and not allowed to do. And there's sound effects. When do we allow sound effects to happen? What can trigger a sound effect? Being able to describe what is true, but also what is not true about the character or the world that you're creating is really, really important.
Oh, yeah. And I think framing it in a positive way so that people get on side is probably one of the most important things.
Yeah.
It's really easy to get on people's nerves if you're constantly telling them what they're doing is wrong. So by showing them what is right, it's a much more empowering way to get people to embody the brand. We spent time doing something that sounds kind of similar to Shipping Things, like creating packing videos for all of our third parties, including our fulfillment and our PR agencies around the world. And it's just us packing boxes. And I'm like, this is how you pack it. So it needs to be beautiful when it arrives on the other end. And unpacking our product is half of the experience. And if it's not done right, then we've mucked up.
So how many people do you have working now on the customer service side, or people who are involved in kind of taking that tone and using it?
We have 3 full-time customer service people, so it's still a pretty tight team. And then myself and Brie act as creative directors. And then I guess a lot of the team are responsible for utilizing our copy, but we've got 2 dedicated copywriters underneath us and then 3 more people that work as part of our PR and outreach team and then another social media manager. So there are a lot of people handling this voice, and to have what is essentially almost 10 people trying to talk as one character, like there's a lot of room for error there. So for us, that's what the onboarding and the training process that we go through with our staff to ensure consistency when so many people are handling essentially the same thing is crucial. And I don't think we were very good at it in the first year or two because we're control freaks and we were just so used to doing everything ourselves, and we probably didn't take enough time to show people how to become frank. But you learn from your mistakes.
Do you have a process now for that? Is there some sort of training to become frank?
Yeah, I just lock you in a room and then tell you, work out how frank you get out. No, I think we're still fine-tuning it. And I think creating the style guide and the tone of voice guide were really imperative to that. So that especially when we're trying to train people that are on the other side of the world, for example, agency partners, and you can't be there with them in the right time zone helping them, creating a document that was informative but also not making you want to tear your hair out because it's so long and boring was really important. And it's just spending time with them and giving people a lot of feedback and having one-on-ones with each of the team members every week and just looking at where they're struggling and I guess trying to find ways to positively reinforce the good things that they're doing so that they understand that that's the right behavior.
Yeah, I can imagine there's all kinds of new scenarios that you've never come across before and you have to figure out how would we talk about this?
Oh my God. Yeah, that's kind of my whole life.
Are there any that come to mind from recent memory?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when we launched Frank Body, we were five friends with one product, no experience in producing products, and no experience in beauty other than being consumers of it. We have very humble expectations for what this brand will become, and we definitely didn't plan on moving into retail or even creating new products. So we've gone through so many incremental changes as a business and as a brand. And the most recent one was moving into brick and mortar retail, which we were so vehemently against for the first 2.5 years of operating. We were like, we are direct to consumer, reduce complexity. And then we're like, no, no, we actually need a presence in store so people can touch and play and experience our products. And translating a brand for an offline experience is so much more difficult than you first anticipate it would be because you have one sentence to explain your product, whereas on your website, you have so much context. And you just don't get that when you have a tiny shelf presence in store and you're surrounded by 500 other products that are all screaming for the same piece of the pie. So that was definitely a really big learning curve for our whole team.
I've been through that exact same problem because before doing what we do now, we made a product that was sold in art supply stores all over the States, also in Australia, actually, but it was very, very challenging because it required a lot of education and our website had tons of videos and all that kind of stuff, which you can't do at retail. So somehow you have to explain that stuff visually or through copy. And that's a huge challenge.
Yeah.
I just want to go straight into like, what made you want to do retail? How did you change your mind about that?
I hate this word, but it kind of happened pretty organically. Mm-hmm. Oh, yuck, I can't believe I just said that. We built a really nice relationship with Joe Horgan, who's the founder of Mecca here in Australia, which for people who are listening and don't know, is a really beautiful premium beauty retailer here in Australia. And she was really wonderful, just giving us advice, I guess, on some big decisions that we were making at the time. And from there, we started to see quite a nice synergy between the two brands. And I think they realized that they could really learn from us when it came to digital marketing, and we could really learn from them when it came to more traditional beauty brick and mortar marketing. And together we realized that this would actually create a really interesting offer to consumers if we can merge the two. And so lots of umming and ahhing, going back and forth, and then scouting the world for different retailers to really work out where we thought Frank should be sitting on a shelf. And we spent about a year doing that and then came back to our original choice, which was Mecca. And so they were really amazing in terms of like wanting to give us a lot of marketing support. I think that they knew that this couldn't be a product or a brand that just got sat on the bottom shelf, unloved, and didn't have any support because people wouldn't necessarily understand the product offering because it's still quite a new category. And I think knowing that they were willing to support us, I guess, a bit more holistically on a marketing front made them feel like the right choice, like they were going to look after the brand that we'd spent so many years building and perfecting rather than tearing it apart. And that's what we look for in all of our retail partners now.
Now, one thing that I didn't know about you guys until recently is that you're based in Australia. I actually did not know that.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah. Even though when we started to get serious about Instagram about 2 years ago, Frank Body was one of the first brands that we looked up to as a really great example. And somehow I just always assumed that you guys were based here in the US. But I think part of it is it doesn't seem to be from any particular country in a certain way. Maybe you are offended by that statement, but when you come to the Frank Body website, it's shipping from the US, so I'm assuming you have fulfillment centers here, or at least the shipping is inexpensive. So I think that is something that must have been a challenge, right? How soon into developing the product did you decide to start building the international plan for it?
Very soon, to be honest. Within the first week of launching, we had orders coming in from the US and Sweden and all of these different places all over the world.
Wow.
And for anyone that's ever tried to ship anything from Australia or buy anything from Australia, you know it needs to like go around Jupiter before it can get to you. So that wasn't really an option for us. And especially in the US, where I guess you guys are so used to the Amazon model where stuff arrives that day or the next day. So Alex and Steve, my co-founders, were really the brains behind driving that international expansion. And we spent a lot of time Googling things like how to send things quicker in the United States. And like that would be how we found our first fulfillment house. And they were really amazing at, I guess, setting up all of the foundations for that. And then for us on a marketing perspective, it was really working out the hierarchy of our messages. So we're Australian owned and Australian made. And in some parts of the world, that holds a lot of weight in terms of, I guess, the quality of the ingredients and the ethical processes that are attached to the production. But in other parts of the world, people don't really understand that or they don't really care. So he needed to have a bit of a universal voice, and we play up the Australian angle when it's appropriate, and then we just let the character and the product speak for themselves in other times. So offering things in local currency and local shipping was a deliberate choice because it feels a little bit less scary for consumers as well, especially when it's a product that they don't necessarily know a lot about. No one had heard of coffee scrubs at the time, so they were kind of already taking a bit of a chance buying this thing that they didn't really know what it was and if they were going to like it. So adding more complexity and more risk into the equation for the consumers seemed like a bit of a silly choice. So if we say, hey, it's in your local currency, it's coming from a local distribution, so you're not having to wait 6 weeks for this product to arrive, it's $14.95 or whatever the price was at the time when people were purchasing, it kind of just reduced a lot of umming and ahhing, and I definitely believe had a really big impact on the conversion. So that was the choice. And we set up the US first about 6 months after we launched, and then the next came the UK, and then we've been in the process of setting up fulfillment in the UAE and in Russia at the moment too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have any logistical challenges with all that kind of setup?
Oh, so many. I mean, the postal system in the US alone is so much more complicated than here in Australia, with taxes changing every time the package crosses a border. And we'd really created our pricing model around the Australian postal system. So there were lots of complexities as we expanded internationally. And then even from a regulatory perspective, the copy on the packaging needs to change a lot. And yeah, there were so many hurdles that we came across, but you just kind of find a way to make them work. And I think it's about taking your time to solve them and not letting them feel so overwhelming that you just decide not to do anything.
Yeah, it's starting to get a little easier over time. And that's kind of what we are trying to do, at least on the packaging side. But the fulfillment, I think somewhere around 4 to 5 years ago, people started to think about that part of the experience a little bit more for entrepreneurs and streamlining that. The service that we used initially was Shipwire, but there's also a lot of them in the US, at least, like ShipBob and many local ones. And a lot of really good ones are a little bit less good at marketing themselves, but very good at doing what they do, which is shipping stuff. So
exactly. We've tried and tested so many, and we're really lucky that we have so many. We've got great partners now, but we've had like the most ridiculous things happen. I remember in Canada, our very first fulfillment center really screwed up when we got an email from a customer with a photo attached to it, and it was just a picture of a bong sitting inside a box.
Okay.
She's like, did you mean to send this to me? We're like, oh God, no, we're so sorry. And we're on the phone with our fulfillment center. And like, you sent a customer a bong instead of a scrub. What are you doing? And you know, you just work through those things. And now you look back and you're like, it's actually pretty funny. But at the time, it felt like the biggest disaster in the world. And now you just kind of expect shit to go wrong. So if you kind of go into that mentality where you go, not everything's going to be right, we're going to come across issues and we'll just work them out as they arise, then that somehow reduces the stress involved.
Do you foresee bringing the retail experiment over to other countries as well?
Yeah, definitely. We actually launched into Urban Outfitters in December, and I spent a large chunk of February over in the US doing some activations in store and I guess just getting a feel for how consumers were responding to the brand and the products. And I was a real creep sort of sliding on over to them. I'm like, hey, how'd you find out about this? Sometimes it went down well. Sometimes people were a bit scared of me. And we're in the process of doing that in wider Europe and the UK as well. And you know, we're going through that lengthy decision-making process that we did in Australia, whereby you always have that brand versus volume question and trying to find the fit that's going to maintain the brand integrity, but also help us move units and introduce us to new consumers. And yeah, it's hard when you're not as familiar with the retail landscape either, because it's on the other side of the world. So it's tough, but it's really exciting.
Did you discover anything unexpected during your travel to the US? Did any of these encounters with strangers lead to any interesting insights?
Actually, yes. There was one girl that really stuck with me. I think it was on Fifth Ave. I was in the store and I just went over to her and I was like, hey, have you heard about the brand before? Or did you pick it up off the shelf just by chance? And she's like, oh no, actually my friend told me about it. So then I went to their Instagram account and then I came into Urban Outfitters to buy it. And she just completely bypassed our .com in that whole process. And I realized that this younger consumer wasn't necessarily going to go to our .com to look at it. They were looking for social proof on our social channels and really wanted to get a feel for who we were as a brand there, as opposed to trawling through a lengthy website. And that was really fascinating to me because I had generally thought it might happen the other way around. So that was a really good insight into how a younger consumer, I'm assuming not all, but at least some, are looking into the brands that they want to associate themselves with.
So how did she find out that it was at Urban Outfitters? Because that is that something that you promote on your Instagram or your social media?
Yeah, I think as we launch into different retailers, we definitely talk about the availability of the products there. I mean, in an ideal world, people are still shopping from our.com, but especially for new consumers, getting to touch and feel the products, especially the coffee scrubs in store, is a really good chance to get them to understand the brand a little bit more. So it was probably just good timing in that sense. It would have been just as we were launching in there and she's gone to look at us and she can see that she can go down the road to have a look at our products rather than having to take a chance and purchase them online.
Now, before we started recording, you mentioned that you felt like people maybe attach too much to what you've done on social media as part of your success. And well, I think that it's fair to mention that you guys have done an incredible job on that side. So that's probably where it comes from. You know, last I checked, you had like 700,000 followers on Instagram and a very engaged group of people. I mean, at least from the outside, what's interesting about how you described the product initially as being, first of all, foreign to people, it's a new category, it looks like dirt, it's not necessarily the most, you know, attractive when you first look at it. But when you go to your Instagram, half or a third of the images are people with the product on their faces or on their body. And what may have seemed like an inconvenient aspect of your product turned out to be something that really makes your imagery very, very unique. So I'm guessing that had a big effect on people sharing what you're doing, but maybe you guys had some other tricks up your sleeves as well.
No, you're right. I think the consumer advocates that we had right from the beginning were so integral, and that was very deliberate on our end. We knew that people didn't know what a coffee scrub was, so we had to spend a lot of time trying to get them to understand it. And we had so many, I guess, little things to contend with. Obviously, nudity on social media, frowned upon. Female nipples are apparently very offensive. So
yeah, we just had a conversation about that in the last episode, actually.
I know. I listened to it, and also Jess, love her. And I read her Medium article and it was really amazing. We actually published very similar articles on the same day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I found it really strange. I'm assuming maybe lots of women had a bit of an epiphany that day. So I guess we were looking at how we could show people what our product was and showing it in use without it being offensive. And then we thought, I think the best way to do this is to actually get our consumers involved, because I mean, we all know the power of word of mouth marketing, and this was, I guess, even a step up from that. It was really showing people that this product and this brand were part of their lives. And at the time, that wasn't really a thing that consumers were doing. Now it's part and parcel of a brand social media strategy. But 3.5, 4 years ago, people didn't do that. They didn't pick up their shampoo bottle and take a photo of it and put it on the internet. So we really had to normalize this behavior. So we started doing it ourselves. We would take photos of ourselves covered in coffee and put it on our own social channels and then on Frank's social channels. And with every package that went out to consumers, there was a flyer that A, told them about the ingredients and the product and how to use it, and then directed them back to our social channels. They'd get the same thing in emails, and we would hero all of the consumers that uploaded content through all of our channels and really started to build this community and, like, really, I guess, championing the early adopters of our brand. And that was so integral, because even if they had 10, 20, 200, 2,000 followers, it felt like a genuine endorsement. And this was pre-influencer rise, I think. Alongside that, we did a lot of work with influencers and bloggers who were becoming a little bit more prevalent. But I really do believe that it was the consumer advocates that were the most integral part to us growing our brand. And now it's been nearly 4 years and we've got over 100,000 uploaded images from customers using our product. And I guess what better testament is there to actually loving the product than that?
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. Now, did you think that Instagram, did you know that that would be the place where it would have the most appeal, or were you testing that? And then since then, obviously, Snapchat became a big thing. Now we have Instagram stories. Today, Facebook launched Facebook stories.
Yeah.
So how do you think about that evolution and making sure that you choose the best channel for your brand, or how did you approach that?
It's a really tricky one. At the time, that was when Facebook ads had been introduced, and I guess there was a bit of a revolt against the platform. People were feeling like it had just, it sold out. And Instagram had been around for a couple of years, but was really starting to gain some traction. And we just noticed the type of content that people were really interested in. And it was all consumer to consumer content, or then maybe from content creating blogs. So we knew there was a real opportunity to be talking to the right people on this platform. And even just from the way that we as consumers were using the platforms, that gave us a lot of insight. Like, sometimes it's really easy to be like, hey, I fall right into the demographic group that we're trying to target. I'm not using Facebook anymore. All of my friends are using Instagram. This makes the most sense for us. And we were so, like, we had the most aggressive strategy. We're posting 10, 12 times a day. This was before scheduling existed, and we were trying to talk to US consumers. So we'd take it in turns, setting alarms and waking up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to post content. There were many a fights on many dates. Christmas Day with family, and you're sneaking off into the next room to post content, because it was so important to us that we were always talking to our consumers. And then Snapchat arrived, and we found it a bit of a difficult transition, because we didn't have a face of our brand. We had a voice, but there was no face. And it had been quite a conscious decision on our behalf that we would not be the faces of the brand. We talked to media about our products and, I guess, the brand story, but as far as consumers go, they don't see us very often. So how you translate a brand that doesn't have a face onto such a live visual platform was a really tough decision. We really struggled with it. I remember propping our little bag of Frank up with quote bubbles all around the office to make our very first Snapchat video. It was like Frank sitting at a keyboard, Frank packing stock. And I was just like, I have no idea what to do. And I think even for myself, I would have been in my late 20s at the time. I felt quite disconnected from the main group of consumers that were using that platform, because I was quite a bit older than them. And we've progressed. I guess Facebook changed, and we spend a lot more time focusing on that platform again and looking at how we can utilize influencers and consumers to create more live content rather than relying on the character of Frank to do it. And it's just this ever-evolving beast, and it changes so quickly that you can't become too attached to any one strategy, because in 6 months it's going to be redundant. And that's the hardest thing that we've had to deal with, when you find something working and you're like, yes, this is great, we've cracked it, and then it's not working anymore.
Will you be experimenting with the Facebook stories?
Definitely.
And have you done some Instagram stories already too?
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of Instagram stories, and we actually get even better traction and engagement there than we do on our Instagram posts. It's a really great tool for us now that we've worked out the best way for us to produce content. So we'll definitely be experimenting with Facebook stories. And if they work for us, then we'll keep doing it. And if they don't, then I think we won't do it anymore. And that's probably something that I think a lot of brands need to really come to terms with, is that you don't need to be producing content on every single platform just because it exists. It's like, pick the ones that work for you and pick the ones that you can do a good job on and just stick with them.
Yeah, that makes sense. What was the key then to figuring out how to explain your brand in the visual medium?
We started to set up some content themes. So it'd be like Monday, we hero all of our Frankfurts of the week. So as I mentioned before, I guess making sure that we really focus on our consumers and don't forget about them is a very important part of our brand and our marketing strategy. And just, we genuinely believe that they're really important to us. So our Monday every week, we celebrate a whole bunch of our Frankfurts of the week and we show them using the product. And it's sort of like this story evolves through the week. We might do a product highlight the next day. We'll do an interview with someone that we find interesting the day after that. We'll do takeovers. We'll do maybe an insight into the HQ. And it doesn't need to be more work than it is, at least when you're a really small team. We don't have a huge production budget and we don't have a huge team to be creating that content all the time. So it's, I guess, a do what you can mentality. Do less and do it well.
Yeah, that makes sense. We talked a little bit about bringing the voice and tone across the team. What other aspects of kind of growing Frank Body as a company have been challenging for you?
I think no one ever really teaches you what it means to be a leader or a manager, or at least in my experience. I just found myself doing it. And I know my co-founders have sort of struggled with the same thing. We were five people doing everything ourselves, and we just had a real like get shit done mentality. We work all morning, we work all night, and you can't expect your team to do that. That's not realistic. And when you're a control freak like I am, or like we all are, handing over responsibility to other people and then making sure that you spend the time teaching them how to do something the way you want it done instead of just being frustrated at them when they don't get it right is a really big learning curve. And all of a sudden, you're not just responsible for your own job and your own livelihood. You're responsible for 30 other people and making sure that they understand the brand, making sure that they're not overworked, that their team's working together, that they know the goal of their project, that they feel like what they're doing is relevant to the wider business objectives, that they have a career progression plan. And you're all of a sudden, you're just a manager and you don't realize it. You just wake up one day and you have a heart attack because you realize how much responsibility rests on your shoulders. And there's a habit, I think, of teams and staff in general to look to their managers as oracles. Like, they'll come to us with questions and it's just expected that I have an answer. And I'm like, I'm just a person. I don't always have the right answer for you. And I need time and, I guess, a chance to really think about how we can solve this problem. And learning to manage those situations and empower your staff to make decisions without just going, oh, it's easier, I'll just do it myself, is one of the biggest challenges I have ever faced in my entire career. And it's something that's really at the forefront of my thinking at the moment. It's what I'm spending a lot of my time trying to better myself at.
Yeah, to be honest, this is why I do this podcast, because, you know, for years I've just been trying to figure it out myself and asking smart people how they do it. And now the weirdest thing started to happen where people are asking me for advice. Oh, and yeah. I'm like, I don't know.
Do you have a piece of advice for me?
No, well, I don't know. How can I help you? What, I'm not sure. What I've learned probably, and we talked a little bit about this with Jesse in the last episode, is just that I think there's no single correct solution. And that's the most frustrating thing, because that's not a fun piece of advice to hear. It's not like, now I know what to do. In order to really provide good advice, usually I'm asking 30 questions before I say anything, just so that I'm trying to figure out, well, is anything that I did relevant to this situation? Because most of the time it's not. So I think that's probably the hardest thing about dispensing wisdom. I can only tell you what worked for me. And when I start asking people about their experiences, you can find an exception to every rule. So that makes it a little difficult. But at the same time, I think maybe the most empowering aspect of that is that however crazy your thing might seem, maybe you're just the first person to be doing it. Maybe that's okay.
Yeah. I'm like the crazy book lady. I don't like to give people advice, but I like to give them resources that maybe certain parts of will speak to them in the way that's the most relevant to them. So I'm always buying people books.
Tell me about some books that you've bought for people recently.
I bought one for the whole leadership team in our office called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And first, I think they took it the wrong way. And then I went, no, this isn't because I think we're dysfunctional. This is because I found this book really interesting. And it was all about team dynamics. And I found it helpful in terms of doing a bit of self-reflection. I thought, oh, shit, I think I do that. That might be really annoying for my colleagues. And I didn't expect other people to read it in that way. But I thought, I found this book really helpful. Maybe they will. I think the Harvard Business Review collections, as much as they're a bit of an airport book, there's actually some really great digestible pieces of information in there. So I recently just read the one titled Managing Yourself. I think you can see a theme in the books that I'm reading at the moment. Mm-hmm. another one on leadership and another one on, I guess, team management as well. So they're really easy. Like they're just a collection of short essays, which is what I really like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give you a couple books. The last one that I read that was in the business genre was the founder of Patagonia wrote a book. I forget the title of it now. I think it's Let My People Go Surfing,
which was
pretty good. Although I would say that it suffers kind of the same problem that many business books do, which is that there's really only 10 pages of really good stuff in there.
Yeah.
And you can just skip the rest.
Yeah.
But that's fine. Once you find the good 10 pages, you're set. My other trick is that it's kind of embarrassing, but I am such a slow reader. But my co-founder, Jessie, is the fastest reader in the universe. So I just give her books to read and then she reads them and then she tells me what I'm really good at finding interesting books and she's really good at reading them. So it works perfectly. Then she just gives me the cliff notes.
Yeah, I find like I don't like being a busy person, but it's the reality of my life at the moment. And I don't think it's something to be proud of. It's something that I'm really actively trying to not be. But the reality is that right now I am. And so if I take the time out to go for a walk, that's when I find I can be listening to something interesting. So I'm also like the crazy podcast lady. I'm always listening to different podcasts and I try to force myself to listen to ones about topics that I wouldn't otherwise, but I kind of fall into the habit of listening to business related.
Well, what are your new podcasts? This is good stuff. I need some more recommendations.
Well, I love How I Built This. I really find it interesting listening to other founder stories. And
that's on NPR.
It is on NPR. I love a lot of what Gimlet Media produce. They're really, really interesting to me. Homecoming is really great if you just want a beautiful narrative. Like that to me was so brilliant. And I love Science Versus, which was originally an Australian show on ABC. And I think Gimlet bought it and took it over to the US. Yeah, so there are a few.
Awesome. I have one last question for you.
Go for it.
Maybe this is something that has come up a lot. What does Frank look like to you? Is that something that's been defined by... Does everybody on the team have a different image in their mind?
Yeah, I think people have slightly different images, but you know the one that keeps coming back to us, and it's strange that we reference another brand, but it feels the most appropriate. You know the guy that rides the horse on the Old Spice ad?
Uh-huh, yeah.
That's what Frank kind of looks like in my head.
Just very suave and cool and...
Yeah, half naked and riding a horse. What else would he be doing?
Well, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. And I really do hope you guys tell the world more about how you've written such amazing stuff for your company because it's really inspiring. If people want to find out more, what should they do?
Well, you can see us at frankbody.com and you can also see us at willowandblake.com.
So that's still going. You guys are active with that as well.
It is, yeah. We have a team of 10 and we work with startups and then bigger businesses all over the world, helping them develop their brand identities. So we do their naming, tone of voice, and then all of their launch communication strategies.
Wow,
yeah.
That's impressive. That's a very good resource. And then on Instagram and on the social media, everything, just search for Frank Body and you'll find that. And then what about you? You mentioned you had a blog post. Is there anything else that people can do to find out more about you?
Yeah, so you can see us at Frank_Bod and then at Willow and Blake. And then if you really feel like it, you can read my article on Medium about my life as a female fill in the blank.
Great. Thank you so much, Jess.
Thanks for having me. It was really nice talking to you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.